Thanks to donors like you, Aquinas 101 is setting the world aflame with the truth, but the next season can't be filmed without your help. Dozens of new episodes are planned, but they'll only be brought to life if you make them possible. Your gift by October 31st will bring the truth to students, families, and people around the world. Please use the link in the episode description below to give today.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Bessie José Cubedini, Visitor and Fellow at Corpus Christi College, Oxford, is to join Pavan Takiwa after 5 years at Edwards and research scholarships in Oxford and Princeton. He has always, especially on art, collaborated and literature, philosophy of language, and a very addiction, ancient and horror. He is the faculty editor for the Journal of English Studies, one of the founders of the Oxford Kolsky Network, and the author of a main publication of Hawking. Higuli Amara, a Hawking literary beauty. Welcome, GRA.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? 1, 2. Okay, fantastic. Okay, so tonight I'm going to talk about two friends of mine, I will say. The one on the right, I think you know him already. That's a picture about my age in the early 40s. And the other one is John Henry Newman. I think he's a few years before his death. I think it would be in the 80s, 81, 82, something. These two people are not very often connected. Okay, so people who talk about Newman, they don't talk about Tolkien. People talk about Tolkien, they don't talk about Newman. But in fact, and that would be the main contention of today's lecture, is to show how important is the relationship between these two people. I'm writing a book on that, and in a way, what I'm going to present tonight is, if you want, the first draft chapter of the book. We can start, first of all, with an obvious biographical connection. The woman you see here is Mabel Tolkien, who was Tolkien's mother. She converted, she remained a widower when she was very young, at the age of 25, 27, I think, because her husband died suddenly in South Africa. She was in England, she was in Birmingham because her family was near Birmingham. And by some strange chance, between 1895 and 1897, when Tolkien was only 3-5 years old, after the death of her husband, she converted to the Catholic faith. We don't really know how she did it. We just know that she did it. But we know that the main point of contact was indeed Newman's charism. Newman had founded an oratory in Birmingham, which is called the Birmingham Oratory. And the Birmingham Oratory went around the outskirts of Birmingham, founding, they call them missions. There was a mission dedicated to St. Anne's. And we know that we don't exactly know what happened, but we know that Mabel Tolkien started to attend services in this church, St. Anne's. And then there she met a man, with this man down here, who's called Francis Morgan. I've been told that my friend Rebecca Lamb came a few weeks ago to talk about Francis Morgan, so I'm not going to say too much about him, but I just want to stress that Francis was, in fact, a member of the Birmingham Oratory. Francis Morgan is the man up there, you see a bit younger, and this man here is John Henry Newman. In fact, Francis Morgan was the personal secretary of Newman at the end of his life. So you remember, if you came to the talk by Rebecca Lamb, Francis Morgan became, after especially the conversion of Mabel, a second father for J.R.R. Tolkien. He was really like, in many ways, he was really a father. He, as an oratorian, he had the access to money, he kept a bit of financial independence. He basically raised two Tolkien children with his own money. He was also very close to Tolkien after he got married, and we have several pictures of him going on taking on holiday himself and his children. So you see, there is a kind of obvious connection, but there is even more than that. I'm not going to spend all night on this, but I can tell you that at a certain point of his life, Tolkien went to Leeds, the University of Leeds, And when he went to Leeds, thanks Francis Morgan, he was hosted by Eleanor Mosley, who was the niece of John Henry Newman himself, who became the godmother of his third son, Christopher Tolkien. Also, we know that in the 1940s, Tolkien became one of the founders founders of the Newman Association, which was funded back then, especially with the desire to promote the canonization of John Henry Newman. It was in the 40s, so they had to wait a few decades. But you can see how Tolkien clearly was very much, at least biographically, related to John Henry Newman. Again, I could go on and on talking about the biographical connection, but I want to talk about something different tonight, which is more the, if you want, the spiritual connection. In many ways, Tolkien was, I would say, Newman's spiritual grandson, and not just because of the biographical connection, which I just illustrated, but because of many other things that we're going to see tonight. And yet, despite this clear connection, there are basically no references to Newman in Tolkien's work, in Tolkien's letters. They have a big corpus of letters, and Newman is basically never mentioned. I mean, the only kind of little hint is the name, if you remember, of Bilbo's grandfather. Do you remember the name of Bilbo's grandfather? Any Tolkien nerds tonight here? Do you remember Bilbo's grandfather's name? No? Sorry. Anyway, Bilbo's grandfather's name was Gerontius, who was the name of one of the protagonists of one of the works of John Henry Newman, The Dream of Gerontius. That's maybe the only connection. And yet, clearly, Tolkien was very familiar with with Newman's sensitivity. Tolkien grew up in this place, which is the Birmingham Oratory, from the backside. His mother, you see there, was buried in Drennell, in the cemetery of the Birmingham Fathers. You can see here, very close. I mean, I couldn't take a picture with all the three of them, but you can see the grave of Mabel Tolkien, the grave of Newman, and the grave of Francis Morgan all together in the same cemetery. I can also tell you a final thing, that when Francis Morgan died, Tolkien inherited a big sum of money, and he left some of it to the Birmingham Oratory, and this sum became, I won't tell you the number, but huge after Tolkien's death. I had a look at Tolkien's will, and there is a huge chunk of money donated in the Birmingham Oratory in 1973. So even at the end of his life, Tolkien will remember the Birmingham Oratory. And so in many ways, Tolkien grew up in the Birmingham Oratory, which was basically the place where all sons were still there. So even if he does not refer to Newman very much, we can safely assume that he was very familiar with Newman's spirituality. And tonight, what I'm going to do to you is to focus on one aspect, in a way, that I think shows. So we somehow verify what a great Tolkien scholar said in 2014, that the extent of the influence of Newman on Tolkien's work is not easy to verify. I think not many people have tried to do that. Tonight we're going to do it together and focusing on one theme. I mean, I could go on for at least 5-6 themes. That would be the plan of the book. But tonight, of course, we don't have a lot of time, so I'll focus on one theme. The theme I'm going to focus on tonight, if this goes on, is the theme of history. The title I gave to this lecture is The Humility of History, and I hope at the end of it you understand why I chose these two words. So, what's Newman's position on history? History, or more specifically, I could say historical change. It's quite difficult to say. Newman, I don't know if you're familiar with John Henry Newman, but Newman is a bit of a contradictory figure, because on the one hand, Newman was someone with a deep nostalgia for the past, a conservative, we may even say, introducing this word, again, not in a political sense, in a sort of a spiritual sense. His sensitivity, especially as we read in his letters, can be associated with what Tolkien described as the hierarchical sense of the vanished past. So there is something in Newman's personality that I look backwards, if you want. At the same time, Newman was someone who was very much embedded in his cultural context. For instance, he had deep interest in contemporary literature, romantic literature, especially the beginning of his life. And some people have talked about Newman as a romantic writer. And I think in a sense, that's quite precise. Also, Newman was someone who fought against what we could now call Catholic ultramontanism. You remember in the 19th century, there was all the debate, for instance, on the dogma of the infallibility of the Pope. But in general, there was a party, not just in Britain, but all around the world, that was like, again, simplifying a bit, forgive this wild simplification, very much on the right side, let's say, very much right-wing, if you want. Again, that's a bit of a simplification, but just to, we understand each other. But at the same time, Newman was absolutely against liberalism, theological liberalism. He was someone who proposed and fought for the principle of dogma, so he was not a defender of relativism, and he was very loyal to the Catholic Church to the point that he really suffered many sacrifices. So in some ways, Newman is a bit of a contradiction, which also explains why Newman in the 20th century has been appropriated by very different camps. Both the left and sometimes even the heretical left, like modernism and the right, and sometimes the heretical right, have tried in a way to appropriate Newman. And in a sense, I understand why, because Newman is someone who had, as I say there, an approach to modernity which was neither reactive, in a sense, neither conservative, nor complacent, nor neither progressive. He was someone keen to valorize, correct, and integrate the cultural changes introduced by modernity rather than merely oppose them on ideological grounds. It's really like we live in a bipolar, in a sense, binary political cultural system within the church. Either you are Orthodox and you go with the ultra-right, or you are a bit kind of heretical, you go with the ultra-left. I would say Newman is really someone in the middle in many ways. Okay, so liked by everyone, or also be hated by everyone. But at the same time, Newman was someone with a deep influence in the 20th century. And as a great scholar of Newman called Janker wrote in a very good book that I like very much, in many ways, Newman was the prophet of the Second Vatican Council. I'm going to spend too much time on this, but you see, this is a network of connections that Newman had in the 20th century. And again, I don't have the time to talk about that, but you can see that a man very much influenced by John Renew was Joseph Ratzinger, especially after the Second World War. This also explains why Ratzinger came here in 2010 for the beatification of John Henry Newman. He was very, very much attached to it. But there is also kind of close connection with Pope Francis, too, especially this Jesuit writer called Shivara, who was one of the first translators of Newman into German. Again, I won't go in too much on this because this doesn't want to be a theological or better cultural history. But in many ways, Newman, we can trace Newman's influence on many different people who have very little to do with each other. From Oscar Wilde, who made Newman himself, to, of course, Tolkien, but also to J.K. Chesterton, Evelyn Waugh. And in a way, many, if someone in the 20th century converts to the Catholic faith in this country, somehow they've read Newman or they heard about it. Going a bit further, if we go to the 1950s, many of the fathers of the Second Vatican Council were very much influenced by John Henry Newman. Again, I'm simplifying a bit there, but I think this table is quite accurate in many ways. What is, going back to the question, Newman's stance on history? Because this is really the kind of point I want to focus tonight. History, and more specifically, historical change. I've chosen this quote because I think it's the clearest of them all, in a way, to clarify what Newman thought. Whatever be the risk of corruption from intercourse with the world around, and I really ask you to think about the world we're living now, such a risk must be encountered if a great idea, in this case, Newman is talking about especially the Christian idea, Christianity, is duly to be understood, and much more if it is to be fully exhibited. An idea, a religion, Christianity cannot really be exhibited if it does not intercourse with the world around. It is indeed sometimes said, I remember this quote, because clearly Tolkien knew that, or at least he was familiar with the idea, said that the stream is clearest near the spring. So let's try to go back to Christianity as it was 20 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and so on. Whatever use may fairly be made of this image, it does not apply to the history of philosophy or belief, which is, on the contrary, is more equable and purer and stronger when its bed has become deep and broad and full. So paradoxically, for Newman, Christianity becomes fuller, broader and deep with the passing of time, with the passing of history. In time, it enters upon strange territory, new challenges, history develops, points of controversy alter their bearing, parties rising around it, dangers and hopes appear in new relations, and all principles reappear under new forms. It changes with them in order to remain the same. In the higher world, it is otherwise, but here below, to live is to change, and to be perfect is to have changed often. I think this is a nice quote, which sums up what is, in a way, Newman's paradoxically contradictory position towards change and historical change specifically. In order to remain the same, so one must remain the same, you need to change. If you don't change, you don't remain the same, but you lose yourself. Let's move to Tolkien now. So let's see how Tolkien approached, sorry about the spelling, I don't know what happened there. Maybe a change of font. Anyway, let's move to Tolkien now. What is Tolkien's position on the same question, especially on the issue of historical change? Tolkien was someone who went through many deep historical changes. He was born in 1892, so late 19th century, the great still a time for the British Empire ruling the world. That's a time also of great optimism towards the future. I will say Europe before COVID, okay, we may say something like that in terms of perception of history. I think it's a bit different now. But anyway, he was born at an age, but he lost his father very soon. He lost his mother. And then the First World War came. He went to fight and he lost two of his closest friends. He went back, he had four children, and then another war. So in 50 years, essentially, the life of Tolkien changed dramatically many, many times. And in a sense, the perception of the change of history really wounded him in many ways. If you remember the Lord of the Rings, at the end of the Lord of the Rings, Frodo comes back to the Shire, is mortally wounded in a way. Certainly, that was the experience of Tolkien. He just chose this quote just to feel it in a way. Imagine the experience of those born as I between the golden, the diamond jubilee of Victoria. So 1897. Both senses of imagination of security have been progressively stripped away from us. Now we find ourselves nakedly confronting the will of God as concerns ourselves and our position in time. I think this quote, 2025, I think starts feeling again relevant in many ways. So think about what I just said in terms of like perception of history and life as being naked in front of the will of God. It's quite common for people to associate Tolkien with a conservative position. Again, we're not talking politics line. I'm not talking about existential perception of history. There are people, for instance, who talk about the idealization of the Shire. The Shire is England at its best moment of history, countryside, happy people, simplicity of life, and so on, a kind of Hamish-like community. There are some people who talk about the idea of the return of the king at the end of the... So Aragorn comes back, and finally, we've got the restoration of the Holy Roman Empire. Christianity is coming back. So that's... Again, these things start to become relevant again in 2025. Also, going a bit... slightly more political, people really associate Tolkien with the idea of defense of the West. The West is a clear idea in Tolkien, the values of the West and so on. And I would say there's something true about it, of course, okay? But I think the big picture is a bit different. More generally, apart from this sort of political interpretations, in general, it's quite clear how Tolkien's work, secondary works in particular, the literature, The Lord of the Rings, The Silmarillion, The Hobbit, are infused of what we will say in jargon are narratives of decline. A narrative of decline, essentially, which can trace back to the ancient world, to Greece, Rome, to the Bible, and so on, is a sort of idea that things go there always bad, things always get worse. There was, in the ancient times, an Eden-like situation where things were perfect, and then history, just a sequence of falls and decline and so on. History essentially, I think about what Newman was saying before, is not progressive. Things don't get better. Things get worse in many ways. And there are some traces of it in Tolkien's Legendarium. Again, I don't know how many of you have read The Silmarillion. Have you read The Silmarillion of you? Just one, two, three, four? Okay. So if you remember The Silmarillion, so just brief Tolkien introduction. So Tolkien wrote The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, but in fact, what he wanted to write for his whole life was The Silmarillion, which is a sort of mythological corpus made of many different tales that kind of is in the background, or better, provides the backstory of The Lord of the Rings. The Lord of the Rings is at the end of the Third Age of the world, whereas The Silmarillion tells the tales of the first and the second age of the world, mainly the first age. Even the fact there are some ages, so you see first, second, and third, and fourth, and Tolkien will refer especially to the third age as the first of the broken and changed world. So there is the idea that at the end of each age, there is kind of an earthquake or a flood or in a way some disastrous event that diminish the nature of the world. So this idea is quite typical of narratives of decline. And there is also in one letter which will even associate this perception of decline to his Christian faith. I'm a Christian, I'm a Roman Catholic, so that I do not understand history to be anything but a long defeat. So if we read a quote like that, we will really be tempted to just associate Tolkien with this perception of decline, a bit different from the one we read in Newman before. This is very true. We certainly do have narratives of decline in Tolkien. We do have a perception that things get worse and perception that everything is a defeat. And but this perception is very clear, is associated with a part of Tolkien's world, and is in particular to the part, the viewpoint of the Elves. If you read the Silmarillion, The Lord of the Rings, you will remember that at a certain point, the Fellowship of the Ring goes to this place here, which is the Forest of Lorien. Again, the picture is not very clear, but the Forest of Lorien, all trees have golden leaves. Lorien is essentially a place where time doesn't pass, where history doesn't apply, in a sense. It's a place where things stand still. And for that very reason, it's a place filled with golden leaves. It's the golden age. You need the word, especially golden age is coming back now in the cultural and political discourse. And the golden age in The Lord of the Rings is in Lorien, essentially. So, and they go there and they have this moment of going back to paradise, and then they need to go away and they're very, very sad. The elves, and in The Lord of the Rings, the elves, we see the position of the elves, especially in Lorien, also in Rivendell, where Aragorn is, but especially in Lorien with Galadriel. The elves are indeed the conservatives par excellence in Tolkien. In fact, Tolkien will say in a letter, the motive of the elves, or I skipped a bit, the motives of the elves, the key idea of the elves is the prevention or slowing of decay. That is to say, change viewed as a regrettable thing. The preservation of what is desired or love or its semblance. That's Tolkien adds, again, sorry for missing a bit, is the elvish position. So the elves are conservative in a way in that sense. History is a decline, things get worse. So what can we do if things get worse? We can just try to build up places like Lorien where time doesn't pass and we preserve the image of the past. The word which is associated also with the elves is the word memory. The elves are the ones that remember the things of the past. The elves, Tolkien loves the elves. I mean, Tolkien loves elves. They are beloved by Tolkien, and they are, in a way, the most iconic or some of the most iconic characters in Tolkien. And yet, there is a bit of a problem. Quoting from another letter of Tolkien, the elves are not wholly good or in the right. They wanted to have their cake and eat it. They wanted to live in the mortal historical Middle Earth because they had become fond of it. So they wanted to live in history, if you want. And so they tried to stop its change and history, to stop its growth. So you see, the elves are nice characters and Tolkien loves them, but there are some buts. There is a bit of a problem there. And the problem indeed has to do with the idea of change. The elves do not like change. And in fact, Tolkien continues, the elves became obsessed at a certain point with fading. The mode in which the changes of time, which is in fact the law of the world under the sun, was perceived by them. So this sort of perception, viewpoint of the elves becomes a bit of an obsession. And the obsession has to do with this, has to do with their perception of time, of the changes of time that Newman was referring as necessary for the development of an idea, changes of time that are, according to Tolkien, the law of the world and the sun, instead it was perceived as fading. Changes mean fading. The problem, but Tolkien would continue, in my universe and not just in his world, mere change as such is not represented as evil. So the elves perceive change as an evil, but actually change is not an evil. It is rather the unfolding of the story. And to refuse this is, of course, against the design of God. But the elvish weakness, the weakness, is in these terms naturally to regret the past and to become unwilling to face change. So you see, that's really like the problem of the elves. And I chose this picture there because that's a picture of the One Ring. And in fact, the reason why the elves at a certain point develop the rings of power is exactly to do that. The power of the rings of power is to prevent change. Lórien is there only because Galadriel has a powerful ring with which, through magic, prevents the passing of time. And if you remember, Galadriel, at a certain point, she has to choose whether to keep the ring and keep Lórien as it is, or rather give up the ring, accept that the One Ring will be destroyed, and that Lórien will fade away. At the end of The Lord of the Rings, the Lórien will not be there any longer, if you remember, and she will have to leave. So, of course, Tolkien, therefore, will say, Tolkien understood and can sympathize with a conservative position, but that was not the full picture for him. There was a partial viewpoint, a viewpoint which certainly reflected an aspect of his personality, but the reality of the world was a bit bigger. Just to make clear, certainly Tolkien was not a progressivist. Just like Newman, Tolkien was completely against progressivism, if you want, as a general category. But in general, Tolkien was against what we will call, in a letter, Sarumanism. I'm not an embalmer like the elves. The elves are the embalmers, the ones that don't want the time to pass. They want to preserve things as they are, but I'm not a reformer either. I'm not a reformer since it seems due to Sarumanism. I'm not really for reform. And in fact, people who try to reform, to improve things through power, are led by, in a quote from another letter, by a desire of power, which is to use all the external plans of devices instead of development of the inner powers or talents. So you see here, we see a contrast, very Numenian. The word development is a very Numenian concept between the idea of reforming things through power, Sarumanism, and instead this development of inner powers or talents. This is the kind of dichotomy there, which also explains in what sense Tolkien is a very Numenian, has a very Numenian sensitivity. So, in what sense we can see Tolkien's Numenian perception of history as a development in the same terms as Newman described it? I will not talk about this in theoretical terms, because Tolkien was not a theologian, he was not a philosopher, but he was a narrative writer. So, and as he said many times in his letters, he expressed what he felt about the world through literature, through the power of creativity. So to kind of develop, in a way, this idea of development, forgive me for the pun, we'll focus on three images. There will be three images which I think clarify in what sense Tolkien has a similar perception of history, as something that, if you go back to what he was saying before, something that develops and goes bigger and bigger, despite all the suffering and the sacrifices. The first image, I don't know if you recognize that scene. Do you recognize the scene? Anyone, do you recognize which scene is this one? Which one?
And the growing sea of the hill above.
Yes, I wouldn't say hill, it's more a big mountain. I mean, it's up the mountain, it's a very high mountain. And on the high mountain, Aragorn is led by Gandalf to discover the seed, the sapling of a tree. You remember that in The Lord of the Rings, and especially in the on Gondor, there is the imagery of the tree when they go to Gondor, it's dead and it's kind of a wither in a way in the middle of the square, the main square of Gondor. Aragorn is there and he's kind of a bit depressed because he wants to restart the history of Gondor, but he needs a sign. And the sign is exactly to find a seed. So the first idea is the idea of the growth of a seed, the growth of the seed. It's an image which is very, very common in Tolkien, the idea of kind of encountering, of treating in general life as something organic, something that develops as a living organism, developing in somehow mysterious way, as you can see over there. Tolkien will use the image of the seed, first of all, to refer to human individual life. I read for letter 1A3. Human life for Tolkien is a seed with its innate vitality and heredity, its capacity to grow and develop. A great part of the changes in a man are no doubt unfoldings of the patterns hidden in the seed. That's exactly the same way Newman talks about development. Development is not change in sense of becoming something else. Development is unfolding the patterns that are already there. Tolkien will also use the same idea to the history of the church, and I really think how relevant this is, this kind of approach. My church, in this writing, this letter, in the 1960s, so during the Second Vatican Council. I'm not sure if you're responsible for the Second Vatican Council, but big debates about the Second Vatican Council. Where is it going? It's a betrayal of the origin. It's a lot of things were going on that Tolkien refers to here. Tolkien himself was a bit worried. He was a bit depressed, especially about giving up Latin because he was really fond of Latin. And yet, this also should not be kind of taken as a side of his conservative position, in a say. Let's see what Tolkien has to say on the Second Vatican Council, responding to a question of his son Michael, I think. My church was not intended by our Lord to be static or remain in perpetual childhood, but to be a living organism, likened to a plant, which develops and changes in externals by the interaction of its bequeathed divine life and history, the particular circumstances of the world into which it is set. This is a very Newmanian idea, very Newmanian, as was saying before. You see, it's a living organism which develops and changes by the interaction between the divine life, so the idea which is always there, and history. The wise man may know that it began with a seed. Really think about Newman's quote before. But it is vain to try and dig it up, for it no longer exists. In the virtue and powers that he had in the past, now reside in the tree. The authorities of the church, the keepers of the tree, will certainly do harm if they are obsessed with the desire of going back to the seed. The idea of going back to the seed, we need to kind of restore the church as it was, or even to the first youth of the plan when it was, as they imagine, pretty and unafflicted by evils. So you see, a non-conservative position, really, you may say. But at the same time, in a very Newmanian way, the other motive, aggiornamento, in Italian meaning like getting kind of adjusting to the new modernity, if you want. Okay, so let's bring the church up to date. This is also a problematic position for Tolkien that has its own grave dangers, as has been apparent throughout history. So you see here, again, how a binary framework doesn't really work for Tolkien, just as it didn't work for Newman. Desire to be obsessing with going back to the seed or the plant, to a stage of the church, the life of the church, the 3rd century AD, the 16th century AD, the 19th century AD, whatever you want, it's problematic. But it is also problematic that you're bringing up to date. That's not the kind of change that Tolkien has in mind. In fact, the developments that Tolkien is sympathetic with are a bit different. I find myself in sympathy with those developments that are strictly ecumenical. They are dangerous, of course. Again, they are very dangerous. But a church militant cannot afford to shut up all his soldiers in a fortress. So you see, it is a militant church, so it's not the kind of church, happy, clappy, clappy church, everyone is happy, everyone is fine. Not really, it's a militant church, but it's a militant church that goes out, doesn't stay in the fortress. So first image, the growth of the seed. The seed develops into a plant, it develops into a tree. The image is found everywhere. Again, I don't want to talk more about the Aragorn and the Tree of Gondor, but in the Lord of the Rings, we have the similar idea, especially with this kind of motif, because the difference, for instance, between him and Boromir have exactly to do with power, with aggiornamento, with the opposite temptation, this sort of conservation, preservation. And in contrast, instead, it's very important, Aragorn will become a Fulia king only when he finds a tree, the sapling of the tree, which is going in a way beside himself. It's something that kind of develops beyond his own effort. First image, the seed. Second image is the idea of renewal. Again, I ask you to go back to the idea of Aragorn because I think that's very, very clear. Who is Aragorn? Aragorn is someone who returns, but the return of Aragorn is not exactly a restoration, okay? It's not reactionary. It's not going back to the past. It's not like bringing the time back to 2,000 years ago in Third Age Reckoning. Rather, Aragorn is a renewer. The key epithet of Aragorn and his narrative trajectory in general is the idea of renewal. I'm sure some of you will remember what is the line, in fact, that is with which Aragorn is introduced. Renew shall be the blade that was broken, the corners again shall be king. This ideal of renewal, I think, is the right approach to see in what sense Tolkien, just like Newman, idea of improvement in a way of is not conservation, is not restoration, is not even innovation, if you want. Rather, it's renewal. Bringing back the past, but in a new way. The tree that was withered shall be renewed. If you remember, the tree was withered. It doesn't come back suddenly. I mean, it doesn't, in a way, go back to its original state. It's dead. And in fact, at the end of the Lord of the Rings, if you remember, they will take the tree away and they will bury it together with the kings. The new sapling will have to be found on the mountain. So it will be a new sapling, but a new sapling will be planted in the same place. It shall be planted in the high place, and the city shall be blessed. And when Gandalf takes Aragorn to the top of Mount Moinduluin, which is this big mountain overlooking the city, he will basically say, give all the lineage, if you want, of the tree and compare it with the lineage of the race of Elendil. So even the renewal, the return of the King of Aragorn is similar to the organic image of a renewal of a tree. A very interesting implication of this kind of approach of renewal is found in another text, which is a text called Leaf by an Eagle. If you haven't read it, please do read it as soon as possible. It's very short. It's a short story that Tolkien wrote about 1939 when he was writing The Lord of the Rings. It's a story that talks about a painter, that guy over there. That's not original Tolkien image, but I quite like it. So there is this painter who clearly is an image of Tolkien himself, who is trying to paint a beautiful tree, but is not very good at it, or better, is a bit inconclusive. He wastes his time, he struggles, but he never actually managed to do more than to do some different leaves detached. At a certain point of the story, Nigel dies and goes to heaven without having completed the tree. When he goes in heaven, he's kind of welcomed by some divine voices who decide to reward him and show him the tree realized. So after death, the tree that he was unable to complete in life suddenly became real thanks to the intervention of the voice. But the key element, the key feature of this tree, to understand exactly what happens to Nigel and also to understand what scientists has to do with the idea of development, as I described before, to understand what's going on with this in this story, we need to introduce the character of Parrish. So in this story, there is Nigel, the artist, the sort of Christian spiritual man, just like Tolkien, who has the temptation to live isolated by everyone else. It's quite clear that he's a lonely character, but he has a neighbor. And his neighbor is called Parrish. And Parrish is basically the symbol of the non-artistic, materialistic, sorry, there is not, no, no, the non-artistic, the materialistic, the non-spiritual man. Parrish doesn't care at all about Nigel's art. Parrish is clearly a model man, and in fact, Tolkien will refer to him as such in a letter. He's someone that also Nigel does not like very much. And yet, in the story, before he dies, Nigel devotes himself to him and do a good many odd jobs. So we have this clear tension in the short stories between the artistic, if you want, the spiritual artistic ambition of Nigel and the circumstances in which he's placed. The circumstances, the modernity, if you want, is represented by this man Parrish. And on the one hand, Nigel wants to do his tree, but on the other, he feels compelled to help Parrish. In the end, he helps Parrish too much that he dies, essentially, because he has not dedicated himself fully to his art. At the end of the story, when he goes to heaven, the divine voices talk to him, and suddenly, in a strange way, Nigel will tell the divine voices that he has understood that actually he really needs Parrish, and that he will never be able to finish his tree without the help of Parrish. So if in life he was kind of engaging himself with Parrish out of his good art, in the afterlife he understands that actually he cannot really complete his tree without the help of Parrish. So he says that to the voices, and the voices say, okay, now finally you understood, in a way. And at that point they reward him and they bring him to heaven and give him the tree. And when he comes to heaven, and finally the full artistic dream of Nigel is accomplished. At that point, Parrish also comes, and here they start working together on the tree. And in fact, the tree is no longer called Nigel's tree, but it's called Nigel's Parrish. It's become a cooperative work in which you have the two different sides. You have, on the one hand, the spiritual, the high, we may say the Christian, the idea, going back to what Newman was saying, and on the other, you have the circumstances. And all the two are kind of a cooperation between these two things that the tree can be renewed, then the tree can actually become fully alive. So you see this kind of dynamic, which is, in my view, is very Newmanian. An idea to develop needs to engage with the circumstance where it is placed. The high, the Christianity, or if you move to the Lord of the Rings, someone like Gandalf, needs to interact with the hobbits. The hobbits are the modern man, if you want. The hobbits are parochial. The hobbits are, quoting a letter, the prototype of the plain, unimaginative parochial man, the non-spiritual man. The hobbits don't know that God exists in the Lord of the Rings, don't know how to pray. You remember the kind of interaction between the hobbits and Faramir, where Frodo says, I don't know really what you're doing there. And yet the hobbits play a key role in the Lord of the Rings. So you see how we have the similar kind of combination, paradoxical combination of two different elements. On the one hand, we have the parochial man with modernity, I will say. On the other, we have the recognition of characters like Gandalf, who are like an incarnated angel, okay? So someone who has seen God, who is kind of very well aware of all the depth that is behind Middle-earth. And yet Gandalf, he understands that actually he needs the hobbits to save the story. He needs them, but at the same time, he's called to make them grow. So again, you see how very Newmanian this is. So you engage with modernity, but not because you want to become like modernity. You engage with the hobbits, but because you want to kind of make the hobbits grow in stature, and at that point they will be able to accomplish the great mission. And this sort of dynamics also applies to Tolkien's own life. Only three of you have read The Silmarillion, but most of you have read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. This is not what Tolkien wanted. Until The Hobbit was published, he wanted to write The Silmarillion. The Hobbit is published, he does not want to write The Lord of the Rings. He wants to write The Silmarillion, he wants to publish The Silmarillion. He understands that at a certain point he has to write about the hobbits, but against his will. I found a few unpublished letters written in 1938 where he goes on basically berating Gollum and Bilbo and the hobbit in general. I don't want to write about the hobbits. And yet, as they were understand a few years later, the hobbit proved to be the discoverer of the completion of the whole. its mode of descent to Earth emerging into history. You see, the hobbits are the ones that allow Tolkien to pass from the big idea, the Silmarillion, the nostalgia for the past, the history of the elves, the sort of escapist attempt to forget the misery of his own life. All this becomes history. And that's only what the Hobbit achieved, which is exactly the experience of Nergal. When he sees in paradise, in heaven, the tree fully accomplished, he realizes that some of the most beautiful, the most characteristic, the more perfect example of Nergal's tie were sent to have been produced in collaboration with Mr. Parrish, with modernity, we may say. In the same way, Gandalf is the mastermind of the Lord of the Rings story, but he can only do it through the hobbits. Again, not hobbits, they remain hobbits, as they are the beginning that were ignorant and parochial and unimaginative, but elvenized hobbits. And this, if you want, sums up this dynamic, this kind of paradoxical dynamic. Final image, and then we just check the time. I don't want to... How much do we have? 5 minutes, 10 minutes? 5 minutes should be fine. So third image, and then we finish, is the image of the blossoming. See the seed, the renewal of the lineage, and then the blossoming of the tree. This image is connected with this idea that Tolkien talks about in a few texts, which is the idea of the tree of tales. For Tolkien, creation, the whole history of creation, from the beginning of time until now, including both real life and literature, is like a big tree with a lot of different tales. And all the different tales are like leaves in a tree. Leaves that are, and flowers and fruits that are uncounted, all different, and yet all belonging to the same tree. So again, it's an image. We need to work with images, not in logical ways. If you want, it's the image of a tree, which is the image that this character in these beautiful short stories sees at a certain point. It's an image of a tree. Let me just show it to you, and it will be later. It's an image of a tree with infinite leaves and flowers, and yet one single tree. This image is also found again in the Silmarillion. Again, I don't want to talk too much about it, but it's also found in musical terms with connected to the idea of a polyphonic concert, infinite polyphonic concerts made of different infinite voices of human beings and yet singing the same music. That's how Tolkien sees the history of the world. Infinitely different tales, but all part of the same tree. What are the key qualities of this tree? Two things. First of all, newness. Second, variety. This tree is made of all flowers. All fruits are not different from each other. All new tales that we are living is new. That's also what art tries to do. That's what, if you want, the art of God tries to do, always to make something new. But it has variety, even diversity, we may even say. Going back to what we were saying before about Newman, to remain the same, you need to change. It's impossible to be truly the same within the tree of tales without being different. It's impossible for an idea to be static. Creation is a dynamic entity. All tales for Tolkien are different. This infinite tree made of different leaves are all different, and yet they're all part of the same tree. They are not autonomous or self-referential, but they are, in a way, related to each other. This, again, is a paradoxical idea in a way which is very typical of Tolkien and I think very typical of Newman. I just read this quote because I think this is another very Newmanian quote. Each leaf, spring is, of course, not really less beautiful because we have seen or heard of other like events. Like events, so all events in history, never from what's beginning to what's end, are the same event. All events are different. Each leaf of oak and ash and thorn is a unique embodiment of the pattern. So translating this into, if you want, even ecclesiological term, the church, every single time of the church is different, is unique. You cannot really like be the same as it was even just 5 years ago, 5 months ago, even 5 hours ago. Every single day is a new event. And yet, for some, this very year be the embodiment, the first ever seen and recognized, the rocks have put forth leaves for countless generations of men. It's a bit of a difficult quote, but the whole idea of Tolkien is that every single new event that we live in the history of our personal life or the history of the church is unique, but is connected also to all the other events in the past. The image is the image of a single tree. Each tree we renew its leaf every single year. Every single year, the leaves are different, and yet they are similar. They share the same pattern with the leaves of since the beginning of the world. This idea of unity and oneness is also typical of Newman. We said before that to live is to change. Newman was saying that not an idea to need to be strong, need to keep changing if you want, but you also need to remain the same. There are infinite voices, but one single music, infinite leaves, but one single tree. And this idea of unity is found a bit everywhere in Newman's text. Again, I don't have the time to read these two quotes, but one it's especially found in describing the unity within the church. In the church, if we compare it, Newman will say in some of his works, if you compare St. Francis and Dominic with the saints of his generation, if you compare any Christian living from the first century BC AD to the 2025, are different or unique, but also all the same. There is a mysterious unity, which also explains why the idea changing is not making a new idea, is actually rediscovering, renewing the same idea. So, to conclude, first of all, both Newman and Tolkien share what I will call an organic vision of history. Organic meaning that history is a development and a renewal of individual stories or individual histories. So everything needs to be new, must be new each single day, and yet they're all in continuity with the previous ones. And don't have the time to elaborate on that, but for Tolkien and Newman, there is, at the end of the day, one single story in particular, which is the gospel story, which kind of is the center of all different stories. I mean, if there is the big tree, the root, the final root is the gospel story. The idea of history, the life of history, is not a conservation, is not a restoration of the past. So the church, but also Catholic Christian individuals, are not called to try to conserve or preserve values of the past. But at the same time, they are not called to break with the past either. So Tolkien is neither with elves nor with Saruman, exactly like Newman. Newman is neither a conservative nor a progressive, if you want. Rather, both of them, I think, will prefer the idea of a renewal of the past. Lorien, at the end of The Lord of the Rings, is abandoned, and yet, if you remember, the Marlon scene will be given by Galadriel to Sam, and Sam will plant it in the Shire, and the Shire will blossom with a new tree, and all little hobbits will become blonde, and they will be so the same color, the golden color that was there embalmed in Lorien will be renewed in a different place. And also the Shire is not really an idealized place that an Amish community needs to remain the same. Actually, at the end of The Lord of the Rings, the Shire will be part of a greater kingdom. The hobbits have grown into something bigger. The nostalgia of Tolkien is a creative nostalgia. It's not an embalming activity. It's open to both what is old and what is new. As he said in a beautiful letter, we have been granted, talking about his friends, as a spark of fire that was destined to kindle a new light, the idea of newness, but with the same thing, rekindle an old light in the world. There is no discontinuity between old light and new light, whose purpose is to testify for God and truth. A final very important point, this renewal is a gift. It's not an act of power, it's not a strategy, it's not Saruman. There will be Sarumanism. The true act of the wise is not really to try to grab power and bring things in order, is not to worry also about too much the evil of the world. As Tolkien wrote in a beautiful letter written in a dark moment of the history of the 20th century, which I think is very relevant nowadays, the future is impenetrable, especially to the wise, for what is really important is always hid from contemporaries. In the seeds, you see the seeds, what is to be, are quietly germinating in the dark in some forgotten corner, while everyone is looking at Stalin or Hitler, and you can put the names you want nowadays. So, this is the very end. Let me just finish with two short quotes. These are for Newman, but in a way, after everything I said, you will see how these quotes are also very Tolkienian. So you can kind of, while I read them, you can think about the hobbits in The Lord of the Rings, the whole trajectory of the adventure of The Lord of the Rings. You see how the two things converge. The first is taken by a sermon that Tolkien preached, sorry, the Newman preached right after his conversion, shortly after his conversion, and it's a sermon about Philip Neri, who is the guy you see on the top left. Philip Neri was a man with whom Tolkien was very much attached, to the point that he decided to use the name Philip for his confirmation name. You see that in his monogram, he put, there is a J, there is an R, RT, but there is also a P here. This little thing there shows that there is also a P. Tolkien was also Philip Tolkien, not just John Ronald Reuel Tolkien. And you see this Philip Neri connection is very important. So first quote from this speech of Newman on Philip Neri. And again, I don't want to get political, think how relevant this is. It is not by the enthusiasm of the multitude or by political violence. It is not by powerful declamation, not by sudden popularity or by strong resolves and demonstration or by romantic incidents or by media successes that undertakings comments which are to last. Again, think about Tolkien. It's not Saruman, not Gondor, not the Elves, not Boromir, no, someone else, the Hobbits. So was it with the Lord of Grace himself when he came upon earth. So it is with his chosen servants after him. He grew up in silence and obscurity, like the Hobbits, overlooked by the world, like the Hobbits, or like Mary, and then he triumphed. So was it in the beginning, so has it ever been since. And the second and final quote comes from at the end of Newman's life. It's a speech he gave when he was made cardinal in Rome. And again, this is very Tolkienian. And again, I ask you to think about really Gandalf worrying about the problems of the Third Age and wondering what he's supposed to do to fight against Sauron. And just before this quote, Newman goes on and on about talking about the evil of liberalism and modernity, of things will go very bad and it will be a disaster. And yet, that's the end. What is commonly a great surprise when it is witnessed is the particular mode by which, in the event, something that happens, not the strategy, providence rescues and saves his elect inheritance. Commonly in the church has nothing more to do than to go on in her own proper duties in confidence and peace, to stand still and to see the salvation of God. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.